Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and the news keeps coming. Less than half an hour ago, Governor Charlie Baker announced a $668 million small business relief fund. The money will go to support restaurants, retailers, and other businesses being hit by the pandemic and by rollbacks that he announced yesterday. Businesses can obtain up to $75,000 from the fund, and some of the money will go to applicants from the most recent round, the winners, if you will, of which were announced earlier this week. Now, that comes on the heel of Governor Baker announcing yesterday that he will roll back businesses and religious services to 25% of their capacity. That means also limiting indoor gatherings, private ones, to 10 people, outdoors to 25, all beginning the day after Christmas. So we want to start today by examining all of these actions and reactions to the governor's latest measures, both their timing and their degree. In a few minutes, we're going to start taking your calls. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But first, let's turn to an expert, Dr. Ashish Jha, health policy researcher and the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. He's also the former director of the Harvard Global Health Institute and professor of global health at Harvard Medical School. Welcome back to Radio Boston. Dr. Jha.
Thank you so much for having me back.
I did all of that and then said the name of the show wrong. That's not a auspicious start. I apologize there. So listen, you heard the latest news just came out a half an hour ago. You know it comes hand in hand with the rollbacks that the governor announced yesterday. Is he taking the right set of steps here?
In a word, yes. I think he is making some good decisions. There has been a balancing act here of obviously we need to save lives. We need to prevent our hospitals from getting overwhelmed. And yet there are real economic costs of pulling back. And I was very, very pleased to see the governor make the announcements he made yesterday. There are areas where I think he could go a bit further, but we should applaud him for that. And I wish he had done it a bit earlier. But again, I'm happy to see that the governor and the state is landing.
So to that point about you wishing he'd done it earlier, I was intrigued to talk to you today because earlier this month on Twitter, you expressed some concern over how the state is responding to this current rise of infections, the hospitalizations. You tweeted then, quote, "For many months, I defended at Charlie Baker, Mass, governor, against critics saying our governor has done a good job. Over past 6 weeks, I've gone from uncomfortable to aghast at lack of action. It's incomprehensible. They must see different data because no rational explanation for lack of action," unquote. Now, there has been action. The stuff since then, the things we just talked about. Also, the governor rolled us back to phase three, step one. Several cities collaborated to roll back further, phase two, step two. How do you know how far to go and when? And what do you watch to evaluate that as a public health professional?
Yeah, these are really good questions. So there is no single formula, right? And what you want to be doing is you want to be looking at trends and where things are going. The way to think about this virus and this pandemic is almost like a freight train in that anything you do will take a while to really have an impact. And once it starts getting momentum, it's very hard to slow down. One of the reasons that many of us were calling for action, essentially these set of actions 6-8 weeks ago, is they would have made a much, much bigger difference then, and they would have prevented a lot of infections and deaths. Acting now, again, I applaud the governor. I think he's done the right thing. I expect that it'll take a couple of weeks before we start seeing it in the data in terms of number of infections. What we know is that infections are followed by hospitalizations, which are followed by deaths. That lag requires patience for people to see, but I believe that this really will begin to head off the trajectory we've been on, and that trajectory has not been a very good one.
So you said, you know, it would have made a much bigger difference then. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what does that mean? What might today look like that is different had these measures been taken 6 weeks ago?
Yeah, I mean, again, we don't have a crystal ball, obviously, so we can't say. But you know, we're generating 4,000 to 5,000 new identified cases a day in Massachusetts. That's obviously a lot. And where we were 6 weeks ago, we were at much lower numbers. Again, when I look at what's happening in our hospitalizations are up 40-50% just in the last couple of weeks. Deaths are up 30-40% last couple of weeks. A lot of those could have been headed off. I want to be very clear that I don't think that these things are easy to do. They have big costs. Shutting down restaurants, for instance, means people losing their jobs, at a time when they don't have any recourse and they could lose their homes. Like, these are not trivial decisions. I don't think that they should be done lightly. But I certainly don't think we would be in the situation we are in right now, where we have so many infections and so many deaths. By all accounts, we have more infections in the Commonwealth right now than we've ever had throughout this entire pandemic. And I think that could have been avoided if we had acted a little earlier.
You know, I think about the fact that someone in your position often has a chance to advise public officials who are making really tough, gnarly decisions, balancing financial needs, mental health needs, social emotional needs, physical public health needs. Is there a decision-making criteria, some hierarchy that you do or would advise, for example, a governor in thinking about making these decisions?
Yeah, so what, and I've spent a lot of time in the last 6 months advising governors. I'm not Governor Baker, but certainly a lot of other governors around the country. And one of the key pieces of insight, and I think that governors come to understand, is that this idea of the trade-off between public health and the economy is ultimately illusory. It's ultimately not a real one, in the sense that when public health gets really bad, when your hospitals get truly overwhelmed, the economy begins to suffer substantially, because you can have restaurants open, but people will stop going to them because they're not comfortable anymore. You can keep things open, but people will stop engaging in economic activity. And the key is to act before you get there, because if you wait to act until you're there, then you've both wrecked your economy and have had a lot of lives lost. And so in the beginning, it feels like a trade-off, but as things get worse, that trade-off becomes not such a trade-off anymore. And a lot of what I have tried to do with governors, mayors, political leaders around the country is help them try to identify what that time point is and when they need to act. And there are governors who I think have just done an extraordinary job, not necessarily based on my advice, just have done really, really good job because they have been able to figure out what that sweet spot is. But it is hard to see it.
So what would you advise that the governor be looking at and for over the next 14 days?
Yeah, so I think absolutely the first thing is, again, we should all be very clear that we're not going to see any impact of this policy for about 10 days. I mean, first of all, it doesn't even kick in until Saturday, though him just coming out and saying it will have some value because people will listen to the governor. People respect the governor. I think, as I said in my tweet, I think he's done a good job. I think people will get the signal that there is something important going on here. I expect nothing to really look all that different for the next week to 10 days. I do expect the number of new cases to start slowing down. I expect a week or so after that, hospitalization numbers were again starting to turn the corner. But all of that requires patience. And there's really nothing we can do between now and then to know whether this policy is going to work. But I will say that it has worked in so many other states that have done things like this that I fully expect it to have real impact here in the Commonwealth.
And that is Dr. Ashish Jha, health policy researcher and the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Thanks so much for taking the time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So now that we've heard from Dr. Jha, we're going to turn to you. We want you to join this conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We get the sense that people have a lot of opinions about these latest restrictions, the need for business relief and support. Whether we are handling this pandemic and this surge effectively right now as a Commonwealth, we want to know what you think. Again, 800-423-8255. And joining us now for this conversation are two good friends of the show. We have Michael Curry, who is the incoming CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. And we have Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and a political writer. Welcome to both of you, Michael and Ed.
Good to be here. Thank you, Tiziana.
Good to be back.
So I'm going to start, Michael, with you and your reactions to what you just heard from Dr. Jha.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't surprised. You know, when I think about Massachusetts, we're fortunate to be home to really leaders in medical research and innovation and hospitals and health centers. And Dr. Jha is among those, right? We have Ball Bittinger and many others that the governor can draw on for input in how to open and how to respond to this pandemic. And Dr. Jha did something which I think is courageous. There's a healthy tension that exists between policymakers, academics, researchers, clinicians, and advocates. And he pushed through his tweet. And the governor, I'm sure, took that in consideration. And we're now drawing back based on what the data is telling us.
And Ed, was today's small business investments, the $668 million, also the result of being pushed by heads of business associations, restaurants, et cetera? And how much do you think that the fact that there is hopefully a federal stimulus bill still coming to be signed by the president, a part of that mix?
Well, the governor has talked about the need to help businesses recover consistently throughout the pandemic. He's been working on this kind of aid for many months now. Certainly, he's very well aware of the cost of restrictions on businesses. So I think that he's finally finding the funds to be able to help out, which is important. And it'll hopefully raise people's morale that they can get through this and hopefully keep doing the right things in terms of preventing the virus from being transmitted, you know, while they're getting this aid.
So, Michael and Ed, you know that part of what we want to talk about today, and again, we want to invite listeners to join us at 800-423-8255, is really kind of duking it out and sorting it out as to whether or not the incremental measures, the step-by-step changes that the Commonwealth has been taking this fall have been the right ones at the right pace and are effective. Michael, overall, would your answer to those questions be yes, no, it depends? You know, where are you on this?
Well, I'm glad you gave me it depends as an option to answer your question, because I've said along, and I've said to you even before in your show, that I think this comes down to lives over livelihoods. We understand that there's a loss of life associated with this pandemic, and we have to factor that in before reopening and jobs. But that's not that simple. Governors have a lot on their plate to take in mind. So one, we have students who need to get back into school, who can't remotely learn. We have an economy that needs to be opened up, or the economic disaster will be borne even by communities of color at a higher rate in terms of closures, in terms of joblessness and unemployment and credit scores, and go down the list. So there's a lot to factor in for a governor, but I want to, and I think the governor has heard others say this, we got to put lives over livelihoods. And I think that's what Dr. Jha did. He talked about the balancing act and economics, the cost of pulling back. He understands it, and we need to understand it, but that healthy tension needs to exist, and I'm seeing it across the country.
Ed, I want to play a little sound for you here from Governor Baker less than an hour ago. I think we've got this for you. Here it is.
We're launching a $668 million small business relief fund. This money will go to restaurants, retailers, and other businesses that have been hit hard by COVID. The program relies in part on President Trump signing the bill, because it creates some flexibility with respect to how we can use federal funds. But regardless of whether he acts soon, the Commonwealth will begin awarding millions of dollars in new funding to restaurants, retailers, and other small businesses as soon as next week.
I was thinking about that in the context of what Michael was just saying about putting lives over livelihoods. And then this second step is, and also working to really maintain livelihoods. So here's this investment. There's Michael's point. But I also think about Dr. Jha a couple of minutes ago saying, actually, public health is the best way to enhance or support livelihoods. Have we been in a false dichotomy in our public policy and in our public discussions of that public policy here over the last, say, 6 months? You know, the reopening began in June.
Well, I think it's complicated, but that's, you know, but we have tremendous resources to be brought to bear and good decision makers in all levels of government. So, I mean, a lot of this isn't even about government. This is not some big policy competition. I mean, we read in the Boston Globe today that Logan Airport is busier than Thanksgiving. Have you seen what the malls look like this week? Does any of this look safe? The nearly empty restaurants near my house are not the problem here. I think a lot of people have just, you know, let their guard down. Not just people who don't take the virus seriously, but people I know who take the virus very seriously, but think they can sort of manage these risky transactions, and they spread the virus anyway. I just think the new normal is not safe, and people have gotten used to a certain level of compliance, and I think that's what's driving all this. I don't think that everything is about what Governor Baker does. There's a culture, there's a politics, there's how people think, and that's not all about government policy.
Michael, I want to go to the phones, but I'm so curious to hear you build on or react to what Ed just said first.
Yeah, Ed, and I'm always glad to be on with Ed. You know, I think about, you know, the Grinch that sold Christmas, that ultimately, if you're a policymaker, and in this case, the governor, you don't want to be that person that tells people to stay home, that you can't go visit families, and that you shouldn't be out in public. But the reality is, we have to take drastic measures, because the data is telling us so. That the incidence per 100,000 has risen to 65.1. That puts us in a list of states that we're watching on television that are top tier states for infection rates. We have to take that seriously.
That makes me think of Mayor Marty Walsh on Monday on our show, basically saying exactly that, Michael. I don't want to be the guy who has to tell people, you can't see your family at Christmas. We have to shut down businesses, but we do have to do what we have to do to stem the spread of this virus. I'm going to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear from Daniel in Wellfleet. Daniel, go ahead.
Yes, very quickly, I'm wondering why Massachusetts has not put in place yet a tracking app for our smartphones, as a number of our neighboring states have. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Daniel. You know, Ed, Governor Baker has said all along that he has strong beliefs about what he can and can't do in the private sphere and in mandating, you know, behaviors and government intervention with individual citizens. Is that part of the answer to Daniel's question about a tracking app?
Some states have it. I'm in favor of it. I was discussing that with some technologists recently. I don't know why we have it. I'm for it. I don't think it would be decisive here. I think it's almost kind of too late to do that. But since we're going to have the virus for a while, I'm for putting it in place if possible.
Okay, I have to admit, I'm not usually the one saying this side of these kinds of things, but I don't want to be tracked on my iPhone. So how do we think about these tensions, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, you know, all the civil liberties, and we have these conversations all the time, and other states, cities, countries are really implementing this, especially I think in some Asian countries. We have to really determine, I think, and as Ed said, you know, we haven't been very responsible with this pandemic. We are so anxious to reconnect and to get out of our homes that it's really spreading this infection at a rate that, as we talked about, Vice President-elect talked about, we have dark days coming, darker than now, which should terrify all of us. So whether we take advantage of the technology and the resources that could help us track and prevent spread, we need to have that conversation.
Let's go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Steve on the line from South Boston. Steve, go ahead.
How you doing? Thanks for having me. I believe Baker and Walsh are doing a fantastic job, and people are family takes precedence over everything, and people are not going to stay away from families, especially during the holidays. I also don't believe that Trump should sign what is, I guess, the COVID bill, as has everything to do with every other country, but not ours when it comes to money distributed. I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks, Steve. And I actually think I'm going to put another caller with you. We've got Joe on the line from Cambridge. Let's hear from Joe as well.
Hey, thank you. I'm glad, Michael, that you mentioned data, and Ed, that you mentioned the importance of what people are thinking about. This is almost more of a question of what people are thinking about than it is about government. And so I want to ask anybody and everybody on the call, what mechanism or what institution do you think should be responsible for making this data available, whether it's, you know, COVID infection rates or whether it's where this money is getting spent locally with the stimulus package? Thanks.
Thanks for that, Joe. So I want to pick up on Steve and Joe, beginning with where money should go and where we should be spending money. We have the double whammy, whammy's not the right word, but the double instance this week of hopefully a federal stimulus package that was ready to go to the president to sign. He has now sent some signals that he's unhappy with it. We have to wait to see what happens there. And this new $668 million fund from Governor Baker. Where should the money go right now? And how do we track it and make sure it's being spent well, Michael?
Yeah, it's both the callers, and I appreciate both of them calling, but I want to urge people, especially as you quote President Trump and talking about not signing the bill, do your own homework, please. Do not rely on anyone else, not even me. The reality is that stimulus bill has critical funding in it. Is it what everything that it should be? Absolutely not. But when it comes to putting dollars in the hands of folks across this country to help them with this economic crisis, it would do that. Is it enough? No, which is why it should have been higher. Two, whether it's businesses that are failing, is the Paycheck Protection Program, there is money in the bill to infuse more money in businesses, I think under 300 employees or so. So there's money there. It's not about overseas dollars that will make a real indent on the crisis that we're experiencing. And most importantly, Tiziana, it has testing and vaccination money in it. We need to take that seriously. And then the same is true for the state. The governor's website, the federal government's websites have a wealth of information that you can do your own research, and credit to the governor and credit to the administration. If you want to find out the truth is right there for you.
Yeah, and I rarely do this, but I would also encourage listeners to go back on the Listen app and listen to yesterday's conversation on the pandemic year in review. We had two medical doctors and Common Health reporter Kerry Goldberg, and we talked in depth about the data that's being collected, how it's being reported, et cetera. It might be of service to you. Ed, so Steve from South Boston also talked about the fact that people just want to and are going to see their families. And it makes me think of this Atlantic article by Dr. Julia Marcus, who is an epidemiologist at Harvard Medical School, who said, listen, not seeing family is a deal breaker for many, and shaming them about that is not effective public health strategy. Instead, we need to engage in harm mitigation and help people do the right things if they are going to see their families. Are we doing enough of that harm mitigation messaging? Have we gone too far in shaming people about their pandemic behavior when it comes to loved ones around the holidays?
You know, this is life and death. It's like Michael said, it's about human lives. Like I see in Swampscott, this is the little town that Governor Baker lives in, where people are lining up in huge numbers to get their COVID test before their Christmas adventure. You know, I mean, how can they drive by his house and go for that test knowing they're going to disobey him and go kill people? I'm just astonished. I'm not really worried about their feelings. I'm worried about all the lives that will be lost by another surge. We already did this for Thanksgiving, and people are going to do it again. I'm not worried about their feelings. I want to save all these people from getting infected. So, no, I don't think shaming them works, but I think that we need more officials telling more people, you really just can't do this. So, no, it's again, it's about culture. It's about politics. It's not really epidemiology. It's about saying, like, we have just this extant feeling out there about, don't worry, we can do this, we're going to be fine, and it's wrong. The new normal is not good enough for the winter and for the pull of the holidays, and it's tragic.
And Michael, Tiziana, is that where you come down to?
Tiziana, just one additional point on that, and I think Ed's spot on. I think the reality is some of us don't have a person missing in a chair at our house right now, so we may be really lax as to how we respond to this pandemic. But the risk is there. So whether I'm sure we all love our grandmothers and our parents and even our kids that may be susceptible to this infection. Don't wait for it to touch your household. This is about public health. This is about protecting your family members. And we all have to be in this together. And you have to be thinking about risk. And people are not handling that risk appropriately right now.
Last question, because I hear it all the time. It is the straightforward, the governor keeps rolling things back, and indoor dining is still open. What do you think about that, Ed?
You know, Oregon Illinois and New Mexico haven't gotten a whole lot of closing their restaurants. It's a great symbolic gesture that probably would have some impact on what we're seeing, but it is no match for what's happening at the malls right now. It is no match for Christmas or anything else. So you're talking about certain pain and suffering for people who work in restaurants, and without being sure it'd make much of a difference. And again, the nearly empty restaurants near where I live, that it's just not what's doing it. So I'm not against it, but boy, is it a lot of pain. So it's become this real symbol. Why are the restaurants open? I want to be like, go to the airport and tell me the restaurants are the problem. So yeah, I feel bad. I hope they don't close restaurants. But again, people like Dr. Jha, you know, think that we should. I'm for it if they're for it, but boy, would I feel bad about it.
Michael, last word to you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the same page. I think that the recent surveys, the Museum of Science, Mass Inc., Mass League survey told us that people trust their doctors, right, for vaccines. I think it's broader than that. People trust the scientists, the epidemiologists, the clinicians. They need to give us guidance. If they believe that restaurants are fine at a certain capacity, if they believe that we can be out in the public but with certain limitations, I'm going to defer to them. I'm not a scientist. But I think we have a wealth of knowledge here in New England and in Massachusetts. Let's take advantage of that and lead the nation.
And that is Michael Curry, incoming CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, and Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And as 2020 comes to a close, we are doing a whole bunch of these year in review conversations. This week, we've done the year in social media and the year in the pandemic. So today, let's talk music. And we've got two local music legends to join us. Melissa Farrick, who is a musician and a professor at Northeastern University, and Prince Charles Alexander, an acclaimed recording and mixing engineer who's worked with Mary J. Blige, Destiny's Child, Aretha Franklin, and others. He was a performing artist himself in the 80s and now teaches at Berklee College of Music. Melissa, PC, welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you? Great to be here.
It's great to have you both back. And listeners, if you've got a song of 2020, call us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Melissa, PC, I'm going to start with the two of you with the same question that I've asked in the other years in review we've done so far. PC, you first. If there was a headline in music from 2020, what do you think it would be?
Well, other than COVID, for me, it would have to be WAP. WAP, which stands for Wet Donkey Kitty Cat.
And, wet something something.
something like that. And it was really shocking to me at first because I have a 9-year-old daughter. And I was like, oh, my God, those lyrics are horrendous. And then I went to female empowerment. Well, a woman should be able to talk about her body. And then I went, you know, so I was flinging back and forth. And it really was a wake up moment for me as a man. You know, where is the agency in being able to talk about our body parts? So it's a challenging song. You know, it's extremely successful at the top of the charts, brings the controversy similar to Strange Fruit brought controversy in the 20s, which kind of highlighted racism. And very often those things that really kind of get under our skin have more import than just what it might seem like on the surface.
And for those who don't know, that's Megan Thee Stallion and Cardi B, and it's about women's sexuality and women being satisfied. Melissa, what about you? What's your headline for 2020?
My headline is going to be streaming, you know, live music. I think if we're not talking about songs, I mean, songs wise, I go with Childish Gambino and Phoebe Bridgers this year. But but as far as like a headline, I think it's how we all created community with the online shows and have come together to try to save these clubs that are just really hurting through COVID.
So we're going to get into all of that. I do want to start with some songs. I think this is such a fun opportunity to bring music to our listeners. PC, you already spoke about WAP, so I want to ask you about another one of your big song picks from this year, which is Blinding Lights by The Weeknd. It was Billboard's number one Hot 100 song of the year. Let's listen to a little bit of that. So, PC, I found this one to be an earworm. Why is this the song? And in this year, in a pandemic year, why did this song grab people?
Okay, there's a few things going on here. First of all, Around March 10th is when I think I was shut down myself. I didn't go back to school after March 10th. There was a song at number one called The Box. And it's really funny because I feel like my whole life kind of collapsed into a little box. and simultaneously, I've got these lights that I needed on me in order to illuminate myself in my Zoom meetings. And then I look at, you know, around April 4th, and Blinding Lights is the number one record. So this idea... it's really funny how these things get into, like you say, our earworm, but it's also a brainworm, that these Blinding Lights, the Box, are coming into being and really becoming successful at this time. Now, going to the music itself, you've got some classic 80s elements going on in here. You've got Take On Me's drum beat from the group A-ha in the 80s, and that kind of sets the song off. You've got all these synthesizer figures going on in the record that remind you of the 80s, and in many ways, I feel like this is connected to the huge success that Bruno Mars had recently with his take on throwback music. And Blinding Lights really signals, you know, for this era of maybe comfort. Let me go back to a time that wasn't COVID. And maybe that comfort zone might have been the 80s for a lot of people.
So I also want to then talk about, and I want to put a pin in this idea of comfort, because I think we're going to come back to it a number of times. This did seem to be a year when we sought comfort in both food and music. But Melissa, you did mention Childish Gambino, who's also known as Donald Glover. We've got a piece of his song here. And I did not know this song. And I'm looking at the title and realizing I'm not sure I know how to say the title right, because I didn't know the song. This is either 4748 or 47.48. How do I say the title of this song?
47.48. I just call it 4748, but I don't know.
All right. Let's listen to a little bit.
I don't know what
it.
The kids call it.
I don't either. All right. So, Melissa, when I said headline, you gave the streaming thing, but you said if music, it would be Childish Gambino. So talk about that.
Yeah, first of all, I just didn't stop hearing about Childish Gambino from my students at Northeastern. And then this album came out on March 15th, right when COVID-19, you know, stopped the United States in our tracks. And this song particularly, I think, you know, to Prince Charles's point, you know, it has this throwback feel, right? It has this like David Bowie, Sly and the Family Stone. I mean, that bass line, that's the sound of that bass. It's just, I mean, I feel like I haven't heard that sound since Sly or since maybe early Prince. And I think that there's this wonderful collision of the past and the present. And certainly Donald Glover's lyrical content is just epic. I mean, he's just crushing it. And the end of the song, which I know we didn't get to, but because we don't have time, but it's, you know, it's this amazing moment where Glover had recorded him speaking to his son, Legend, about love. And his son says, you know, when he asks him, who do you love? And he's listing these people. And then he goes, I love myself. And he goes, Daddy, do you love yourself? You know, and it's just like, I mean, I even choke up right now just because it's just, and then, you know, mommy, does mommy love herself? Yes, mommy loves herself. So it's just this beautiful moment. And it's really long too. I love that the song is over 6 minutes long. So I'm kind of a sucker for that.
So PC, supposedly that is Childish Gambino's last record. Do you think that will be the case? And do we lose something in the music world if that's the case?
That's insane. I can't believe that. First of all, the two biggest stars we have in America are both Canadian. We've got Drake and we've got The Weeknd. So we need you, Childish Gambino. Don't go away.
The Canadians.
So we at least are
going to
protest that.
I know the Canadians are just—they've just taken over. They're dominating.
They're the best songwriters, man.
All right, so actually we have a little bit of Drake here, and we were going to get to it later on, and so I admit I'm scrambling through my notes to find the name, which one we have. It's one of our producer Zoe Mitchell's favorite Drake songs. It's called
Laugh
Now,
Cry Later. Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Yeah, sometimes we laugh, sometimes we cry, but I guess you know now. Baby, I took a half and she took the whole thing. Slow down, baby.
So, PC, you have some real thoughts on the influence of Drake.
Well, you know, I've actually been looking at the data, just who has been at the top of the charts. And Drake has dominated the 10s, and he's beginning again into the 20s. This has been the most popular. He is the Beatles. He is our Beatles. Now, whether you like him or, you know, or can't stand him, for me, as somebody that needs to know the techniques and the concepts and where we're going with songwriting, where we're going with production, I have to keep an eye on who is at the top of the charts. And that has definitely been for about 10 years now, that's been Drake. There are some other people that are really, really good songwriters, like Post Malone is a really great songwriter. I think the work of Harry Styles was phenomenal this year. You know, Jason Derulo's got some really great vocal performances and songwriting. I'm trying to think of, I think Don't Start Now, Dua Lipa, that was really a great production this year. But Drake is kind of the trendsetter, and he's doing things creatively and goes wherever he wants to go. And that's tricky for artists, because many people want to come to you for, once again, their comfort zone. And when you try something new, most artists struggle with something new, and Drake does it effortlessly.
All right, I'm going to go to the phones here. We've got Andrew on the line from Somerville. Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, one song I've been listening to a lot is A Touch of Grey by the Grateful Dead. There's a line in there, like at the beginning, it's I Will Survive. And then towards the end of the song, it changes to We Will Survive. And that's been kind of helping me a lot, you know?
Thanks for that, Andrew. And of course, when I first heard I Will Survive, it made me think of another survival song by Donna Summer. But Melissa, are we going back to our comfort songs from younger years as well during this uncertain time?
I don't know, but that's a really good question. I think that one of the things that PC just talked about is so interesting, though, because the idea of artists being able to, you know, take these chances and go outside the lines a bit, or explore and show us their more intrinsic, you know, the place where they're coming from. It's interesting because I wonder if in COVID-19, in shutdown, it hasn't allowed artists to be more brave in some ways. And for the receivers, the listeners, maybe we're more able to make choices out of a deeply emotional place rather than, you know, driving in the car and picking up the latest pop song. Or I don't know. I had just thought of that while we're on the air here. But yeah.
I also have to tell you, the blowback I am going to take for saying Donna Summer and not Gloria Gaynor.
I was going to say something, but I'm like, I'm not going to blow you up on the spot.
I'm sure it's not the first time.
You're all right.
I make those mistakes all the time, too.
Thank you. Melissa, I'm going to stay with you for a minute longer, because I do want to spend these last couple of minutes talking about online and streaming. And I'll start with you, because it was your headline. How are you reflecting about that?
Well, we just have a whole new way of being able to play live, and people have gotten used to it. So for someone like me that doesn't want to tour anymore, you know, this is awesome. I'm able to play to thousands of people from all over the world. And before, just people weren't as willing to do that. They weren't as willing to jump online and watch you play. But now it's just, like I said, it's a new norm, and I'm able to also take the money, the proceeds, any tips. There's just that, you know, we have Venmo, we have ways for people to give money now, and being able to contribute back to the clubs. And I've been sending a lot of money to the Tegan and Sarah Foundation and to Black Lives Matter. And, you know, we're able to kind of, I don't know, I feel like there's been just so much giving and so much trying to build community, even though we are isolated. And I think that, I hope that that continues as we come out of this.
That's encouraging. It's heartening. And PC, I also want to talk about one other way that online streaming of music and virtual performances built a lot of community, and that's the Versus Battles, a webcast series of virtual DJ battles. You know, that there were a number of just giants who engaged in these Versus Battles. I want to hear part of one between Jill Scott and Erykah Badu. And this one was less of a battle, a little more kind of hype, both women switching off who was DJing. Audience of 700,000 people. So cool. Let's hear.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe you don't recognize what you got between your eyes. So I'm going to set you correct so you can get what you should get. Yeah. Intuition.
Yeah, I could keep listening to that, but yeah, we do have great. A clock. We have to pay attention to talk about these battles, because they were as the word should be, epic.
So full disclosure, when I first heard that Swiss was going to battle Timbaland, I was like, oh, why do we always have to fight each other? Why can't we come together and love each other? So then I got into it on, you know, Facebook and Twitter with a whole bunch of people. They're like, but that's how we do it these days. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's how we've always been doing it in the rap world. And, you know, so I kind of left that alone. And then when Erica and Jill finally did, I think it was the 10th one. So you had the Swiss Beats, Boy Wonder, The Dream, Neo, French Montana, Scott Storch, Ryan Tedder, T-Pain, RZA, Teddy Riley, and Babyface. That was pretty good. You know, it's kind of a love fest, really. These things are called verses, and they're kind of portrayed as battles. But I like them when they're love fest. And you could see the love fest with Teddy Riley and Babyface. And right after that was Erykah Badu and Jill Scott. And in the vein of it being the love fest, this one was the best one. You know, the music was great. Their appreciation for each other was great. And I think we culminated with a couple of legends, Patti LaBelle and Gladys Knight, you know, did a love fest also. So my only problem with it is they need to call it love fest instead of verses. But I love the fact that we're able to go back into people's catalogs and bring that music forward. And once again, it ties into what Melissa was saying about COVID. And what you were saying about our comfort zones, I think people are trying to get to something that really works for them in these times that are so unknown. The next day is an unknown. The next week, the next month is an unknown. So we're trying to grab onto things that are known to us.
All right. Well, Melissa, we are just about out of time. A shout out to a live music venue that you either has closed or that you're hoping to see stay open, just very briefly.
Yeah, I'd say the Parlor Room in Northampton and of course, Passim right here in Harvard Square.
All right, that's great. And that is Melissa Farrick, musician and a professor at Northeastern University, and Prince Charles Alexander, who is an acclaimed recording and mixing engineer and now teaches at the Berklee College of Music. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Tisha.
Thank you, Tiziana.
We want to end today with another installment in our Living Through Corona series. But our guest, Santa Claus, has asked us to take a moment now to warn you listeners that our younger listeners may want to skip this particular conversation as it could reveal some trade secrets. So we are going to give you a few seconds here of Frank Sinatra's Jingle Bells in case you need a chance to turn off your radio.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Okay, so with that done, the town of Bedford's Community Santa program is in its 75th year. The program gives any Bedford household that wants it the experience of having Santa visit the children on Christmas Eve. The program's origins are local folklore. Bedford has a military base, and after World War II, a local selectman, Clayton Morrill, founded it to make sure that every child had a gift during an uncertain year. 75 years later, the program is going on, despite the pandemic, virtually, and David Johnson is one of Bedford's Santas. A St. Nick since 1983, he joins us now. David, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It is great to have you. So now, David, you actually live in New Hampshire. You've never lived in Bedford, but you have been committed to this program for nearly 40 years. So tell us why. What is so magical to you about it?
Well, my wife is from Bedford, and I learned about it through her family. Her father was a driver. Her sister was a checker. We lived in Wichita, Kansas, and we spent a couple of Christmases back here when our daughter was young, and I got roped into being Santa. And we ultimately moved back to New England, and I just continued, and I have such wonderful memories of the program and the people I've met.
When we are not in a pandemic, how does the program work?
Well, when we're not in a pandemic, people in the town, they get gifts to a central location, and those gifts are meted out on Christmas Eve to, oh, it can be up to, I think, 35, 40 Santas who travel throughout the town taking those gifts to homes. I have been doing one route for a long time, and I have seen kids grow up. I've seen them get married. I've seen them have their own kids, and I've delivered gifts to their kids.
That's fabulous. So this year, you couldn't do it the same way you normally would. So you provided personalized video messages to kids. Is that in specific families?
I did. My wife was, instead of driving the sleigh, she was my official camera person. We got a backdrop that was Santa's workshop, so I put on my suit that my wife made, and sat in front of the backdrop and pre-recorded 23 messages.
Can you do a little bit of one of those messages for us, like some little piece of it that you remember?
Oh, well, I can tell you, a lot of them I would start out and I would say, well, hello, so-and-so. I'm sending you this message from the North Pole. I'm sitting outside of my workshop right now. The elves are inside and they're busy preparing gifts for Christmas. I just returned from the reindeer barn and I was telling the reindeer how we won't be able to go to Bedford tonight. They're very disappointed, but they understand.
You know, as you're doing this, you just talked about the generations of families that you've done this with over the years. Is there a family or a child who's really on your mind this year?
You know, I think all of them are on my mind. There was one little boy who was going through some issues. He was having a hard time connecting with people. Yet when I came in the house, he connected with me. He came right over to me and just looked up at me with his big blue eyes and started to talk. And his mother said, thanks so much for coming, because he just didn't typically do that.
You know, it is really striking that this program was started, you know, in a post-war era. It was an uncertain time. It was a hard time. And now we're in this another just really tough year for families. What is being able to provide some consistency of this joy and this message of seasonal happiness, seasonal love? What does it mean, do you think, for families to have this year?
Oh, I think it'll mean a lot to the families. Just seeing the twinkle in their children's eyes when they hear Santa and Santa talks to them and calls them by name. Like I say, I had information on the kids, and if someone had done well in school or had done well in a sport, I let them know and I said, that's great. I know your parents are proud of you and I'm proud too. So hopefully it's good for these kids and their self-esteem because they're going through a tough time.
So I'm assuming you're settling in for a cozy, maybe smaller Christmas yourself this year. After this experience, you know, what are you most grateful for and most looking forward to this Christmas?
I'm most grateful for my health, for the fact that I have a roof over my head and food on the table and a lot of loving people around me. And I'm grateful that I have the memories of the Santa program for 42 years, and I'm looking forward to probably not another 42, but many more.
And that's David Johnson, who's been a part of the Bedford Community Santas program since 1983. David, thanks so much.
Oh, you're most welcome. Merry Christmas.
Thanks. And David, can I ask a favor?
Sure.
You're my only Santa I'm going to talk to this year. Can you give us a little bit of your Santa voice?
Sure. Oh, Merry Christmas.